Welcome in, everybody, to the Thursday edition of Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Got a good show coming up for you here on this Thursday. Want to remind you guys, before we jump into it, though, to check out the link in the description of the show for the UFO Disclosure Symposium. It's coming up this Memorial Day weekend, May 27th through the 29th. Everybody who's anybody in the UFO community, and I mean not just experts in the field, but maybe some governmental folks as well that you've heard of, are going to be at the UFO Disclosure Symposium in Vernal, Utah. Again, coming up May 27th through the 29th. Now, you may say to yourself, self, why would I want to go to this particular symposium? Well, there are four videos that were previously top secret that have not been seen by the world that are going to be at this symposium. That's why you want to either get to Vernal, Utah to see this symposium by with your own two eyes, live and in person. But you may say, well, Tim, the cost of airline tickets and hotels and everything. Well, that's okay. You've got two packages that are very affordable, either a VIP package where you yourself can have dinner with the speakers and then join in an exclusive event, or you've got a general admission package, again, very affordable, for the UFO Disclosure Symposium, or you have got a package there for streaming from the very comfort of your own home, which is the least expensive package, which is incredibly affordable, which you can sit there and while you're maybe enjoying some Memorial Day barbecue, can sit there and watch this conference, which has four videos, four top secret videos, previously top secret videos, that will be discussed by these experts in the field. Again, go to the link in the description of the show. Click on that link. It costs nothing for you to look. Just go ahead and click on that link. See all the different experts that are going to be there in the UFO UAP field. And check it out for yourself. We're encouraging you to do so. Let's jump into today's program, shall we? It is going to be an exciting one, folks. I'll tell you that. It's an intriguing story today. It's a human interest story. And with it, a paranormal twist that I'm sure you're going to love. Our guest is author Kirsten Micklewaite. I want to be careful because here in Minnesota, we have Kristens and we have Kirstens. And this one is a Kirsten. Kirsten Micklewaite is a professional copywriter and editor by day and a writer of fiction and creative nonfiction by night. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, where she's at work on a new novel, which is what we're going to talk about today. The Ghost Marriage is Kirsten's first memoir. The book tells her story of spiritual connection and surviving divorce after 50. Let's bring in to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show, Kirsten Micklewaite. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. This book, and we're going to set it out there right away, is more a book about, and this week has been dedicated to relationships, and that's what this book is all about. I was telling you a little bit before the show about Wayne, our guest on True Crime Tuesday, and how his book was really about not just about true crime, but it was also about the relationship with his mother. And we're going to talk a little bit about relationships today, too, in the ghost marriage, and about the paranormal supernatural twist in your book as well. Let's start first with a little bit, Kirsten, and talk about you and talk about your upbringing and how you became an author, because and a journalist and whatnot. Tell me a little bit about Kirsten.
Okay. Well, I grew up here in the Bay Area. I grew up in Palo Alto, which was a wonderful place to grow up. Went to UC Berkeley as an undergraduate, lived in Europe for a while, and came back and decided to put my English major to use. And pretty much my entire career, which has been 4 decades, has been either in the publishing industry or publicity, or most recently working in higher education, doing fundraising publications. So they all told me that an English major would, you know, that and a dime would get me a cup of coffee, but it's actually, I've built my whole career on it. So I still really enjoy doing it. As for the book,
let me stop you, because I want to ask you about publishing now. I share a little bit of a love of that with you. I I know it's not much, but I was on the high school newspaper, and really I was more on the photographic side of the newspaper, but print really did appeal to me. Let me ask you this, as far as publishing goes, what was it about print that appealed to you?
I think just being in an industry where I could use my writing and editing skills, that was so far beyond what I expected, you know, with my English degree graduating in the late 70s when the economy was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. So my first job was in the San Francisco Bureau of McGraw-Hill Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And I was an editorial assistant on Aviation Week and Space Technology, which I am not a science type, or I wasn't at the time. I've since gotten into STEM. But so I went from writing very verbose academic papers. You know, I did my honors thesis on James Joyce, to having to really quickly learn the journalistic trade and work for a couple of seasoned journalists about aviation and space. So that was a real, a real steep on-ramp learning curve, but it taught me that there are all these different kinds of different styles of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use writing to do so many things. So it's really been a versatile skill.
Now you're hitting on something that our audience is going to want to know a little bit, at least about, and that is you're writing about space. Tell me a little bit about maybe one or two of your most favorite articles that you wrote about that
was so many years ago.
There had to be something that was impactful to you, though. Did you remember one or two that you went, wow, I'm actually writing about this?
I do remember one story, which was a PSA flight that was taking off out of San Diego Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And it crashed. It hadn't even made a full ascent yet. And it crashed with a private airplane.
Ooh.
And I think both planes fell to the ground and everyone died. And it was a big disaster. It was all over the news. And I remember my boss telling me, because he was one of these, you know, hard journalist types, and he'd written about aviation for years. And he said, the most dangerous times on a plane are taking off and landing. You know, that's when probably 90% of the dangerous stuff happens. And I think about that every time I take off in an airplane. Yeah. So, I mean, just in terms of the skill of the pilots, the technology they have to use, everything else is kind of just coasting, mm-hmm. unless, of course, you have engine failure or something. But that really made an impression on me. So that's one story I still remember. But honestly, that was many, many years ago.
You're a nervous flyer, aren't you, Kirsten?
Not really.
Okay.
But I'm a thoughtful flyer. That did stick with me. Yeah.
I try not to think of it, and I'll tell you why. My mother's father flew very small planes, and you know, like crop dusters, like the two seaters, the open two seaters, wow. You know, the Red Baron type two seaters, where you're out in the, you know, there's nothing between you and the air, basically. And crashed a couple of them.
Wow.
Yeah, like ended up in a tree, crashed a couple of them.
Yeah, they probably weren't going that high.
No.
So maybe
your going,
chances of survival were better. But
yeah. Not going that high, but it hurt. it still
I
hurt.
I can imagine.
Still hurt when you hit the tree. So you spent 40 years with the printed page, and I have to ask, when is it that you make that turn then from publications to finally going, you know what, I want to take these ideas that are here in my head and I want to put them to the page?
Yeah. So that happened for me around the year 2000.
Okay.
I was a stay-at-home mom. I lived in the Napa Valley. I had I still have two children, but they were really young at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I took an online writing class. And then I did the Artist's Way workbook by Julia Cameron, which basically says, you know, you tap into your creativity and She told stories of accountants who became screenwriters and, you know, people who had these sort of artistic epiphanies. And I thought, well, that'll never be me, but it would be fun to just be more creative in my own writing. And sure enough, when I finished the workbook, I got this idea for a novel, not this book, very ambitious novel set in 6 different historical periods based on reincarnation. Mm. And I spent the next several years writing this novel. So it happened for me very quickly. I really didn't expect to be a fiction writer at all. It was not on my radar. But this workbook, if anybody's interested in becoming a more creative writer, I recommend it because it jogs something in your brain. It taps into something deeper. And it got me to writing fiction. So with that novel, I got an agent and she was shopping it around and we were never able to sell it. So she said, it's time to move on to the next project. And I was starting to do that when the events that I talk about in The Ghost Marriage started happening, which was basically a decade, the most difficult decade in my life. And I wasn't doing any creative writing at that point. I was trying to invent myself professionally. I was trying to support my children. So as I was kind of coming out of that decade, everybody I knew said, you know, you're a writer. You really need to write a book about this because it's pretty incredible what all the things that happened. And I had absolutely no interest at all because it had been painful enough to live it. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go back and revisit it. I didn't want to have to spend all that time and energy during a period of years that were so painful and I was so happy to be done with.
Yeah.
But, and I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but we can come back to it later.
Well, actually, you know what? Let me stop you there.
Okay.
And we can come back to that point you're on right now. But I want to go back because we're kind of missing a huge chunk here with our audience, as far as our audience is concerned. And you've shopped this book about reincarnation. Reincarnation is a huge part of an interest with our audience. Tell me. What was the inspiration behind the book with reincarnation? And what is your outlook on reincarnation? What is it that fascinated you about it?
Well, I personally believe in reincarnation. That's just part of my belief system.
Yep.
I had recently read a book that used the multiple point of view style for writing so that each chapter was told by a different character in the book, in the first person.
Okay.
And the idea that came to me was telling a bunch of stories in this first person narrator from all these different viewpoints. I should say that every other chapter in the book is a standalone short story set in a different historical period. So I started with Minoan Crete. I moved through ancient Rome, China during the Mongol period, Bourbon, France. I just kept each alternate chapter was a different story in a different historical period, all told in the first person. And woven between those chapters was a running story of a present day woman. It was very autobiographical. It was a woman living in the Napa Valley with 2 children. And it seems very disjointed, but as you progress through the book, these different kind of clues and themes help the reader to understand that this is the same soul telling the story through all these different lifetimes.
Okay.
And so the current day protagonist, the woman, is also the woman in ancient Rome, the man in Mongol China, that it's all the same soul throughout this time. I thought it was a brilliant idea.
It is.
And I think it would get a lot better reception today because at the time, New York editors felt like this was a really woo-woo California thing.
Hmm.
But I think now a lot more people are open to the idea of not only reincarnation, but speculative fiction that you know, suspends disbelief and gives you these new things to think about. So one of these days, I'm going to have to go dig that novel up and see if maybe I should try again with it.
I think sooner or later. I mean, I you know, I've been in touch with your agent, and there are imprints out there that are strictly supernatural and paranormal that I think would absolutely take it in a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think that I'm sorry, what was that?
Publishing was very different back in 2005. You know, it was just in some ways it was more expansive. You know, the publishing industry has boiled down to basically five big publishing houses, traditional. But I do think that readers have, you know, all these different genres have bubbled up, and I think it would have a lot better chance.
Yeah,
today.
There's one right here in Minneapolis and in Minnesota, Llewellyn Press, that I know would probably chomp at the bit for that. Let me ask you this: as far as reincarnation goes, it sounds like as you're writing this book, it almost may have come from an autobiographical source. Do you feel like you connected with those lives that you wrote about in that book?
You know, I'm not someone who has had a past life experience per se, but I picked these particular periods in history because they fascinate me.
Okay.
And I've lived in Rome. I love the ancient culture so much that I suspect there's some connection there, that maybe I did have a past life in Rome. And, you know, because I'm not more hypersensitive to it, I don't know exactly, but that's how it connected with me. Is these were, you know, I there's a chapter that's set in an Amish community in the 19th century. And I just feel a particular fascination with the Amish culture. So, you know, I'd have to go under hypnosis, I think, to figure out.
Well, has there ever been a time, like, this is going to seem like a horrible example, so forgive me, Kirsten, but you know, have you ever been like in an Amish furniture store or something, and you look at something on television that's of Amish nature, and you go, you know what, that feels familiar to me, or you have just a quick flash where you think, you know what, I connected that, and more in just a that feels familiar type mode, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I had been to visit, I think the name of the community is Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Back in about 1995, I think. Mm-hmm. And we toured the community and saw the rooms and the furniture and the beautiful circular barn that they, you know, they were really into functional design, which I'm fascinated with. Mm-hmm. And I just thought I could totally live here. You know, this pushes all my buttons, and the Amish music I just love. So, yeah, I think there's a special connection there. Absolutely.
I've had experiences like that too at times where you just know you've been somewhere before, or you feel that there's you know, Colorado, the Stanley Hotel. There's certain people who go there and they're like, you know what, I'm home. I feel like I'm home. You know, but it's more than just, I feel like I'm home. Like, you know, you've been there.
Yeah.
You absolutely know you've been there in a previous
Sometimes
life.
You get those little flashes of deja vu, like you're seeing what you're seeing, but you're a different person when you're seeing it.
Yeah. Those types of experiences. I mean, at the same time, it feels so comfortable and so natural, but at the same time, it's a little throttling. It's kind of, you know, you almost look forward to it in that your hopes and wishes are that, yes, I want to believe that there's more to this, you know, that I'm going to spring from this body into another body, and that we're going to do this all over again, and I have something to look forward to. But at the same time, you go, gosh, I hope that this isn't just it, and that this isn't just my imagination, you know?
Yeah,
it's one of those things. So I'm sorry, I interrupted a point you were going to make about the book. Do you remember where we were at?
About the ghost marriage?
Yes, you were talking.
Don't ever interrupt me, because I know,
I'm sorry, Kirsten. So we were talking about going from the writing the book about reincarnation. and getting the spark, I believe, for going from that book and, of course, being turned out by New York publishers. Again, New York publishers, I think, are on a different level than other publishers, of course. Mm-hmm. But look up Llewellyn Press. I'm telling you, look up Llewellyn Press there, Kirsten.
Okay.
And I, you know what? I'll even get the number to your agent, because I think that's a natural fit. That just feels good to me. And then you were talking about going on to the next project, which I assume is The Ghost Marriage, a memoir?
Yes. So okay. I do remember what I was going to say there.
Okay.
I did not want to write the book. I felt like, you know, living it once was enough. I don't want to have to relive it. And I was still scrambling for all the reasons we'll get into. I was really struggling to just support myself and my family. And at one point, I saw a medium twice in the course of the book. Mm-hmm. Once when I first separated from my husband, and I just wanted to know that everything would be okay. I just wanted some reassurance. And then I went back to see the medium again 2 years after he died, because I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to find out why this had all gone down the way it had. And I think it was during that second reading, my late father came through and he was holding a copy of the book, Eat, Pray, Love. And he said, you need to write a book like this. Mm. And I was also working with a spiritual kind of coach, kind of a life coach. And he wasn't a medium per se, but he had a very strong instinct. And he kept saying, I'm seeing you writing a book. And I'd say, no, 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 no. And he'd say, I'm sorry. That's what I keep seeing. And so when my dad came through, and I'm one of the people who just loved Eat, Pray, Love. Some people, not so much, but mm-hmm. I just loved it. And I'd gone to one of her readings and I'd met her. And I just felt like she really did a masterful job with that memoir. And that book wasn't even out when my dad died. So yeah. He's coming to me from the other side with a book he didn't even know about when he was living. And that really made an impression on me. Like, okay, maybe this is something I am supposed to do. And honestly, I just had faith in that gesture that he's telling me something from the other side. Maybe I just need to do it. And that's what convinced me to sit down and write the book.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So you see, you even got it, I think you were a little worried that there wasn't much paranormal to your stuff here today. And see, you've seen mediums. You believe in reincarnation.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm a big believer. It's just some readers have said, oh, she doesn't get to the paranormal stuff until, you know, the last third of the book. You have to get through my whole horrible divorce and all of, because the message of my book, Tim, is the importance of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And I could not have forgiven my ex-husband without these paranormal experiences.
Sure.
They were what got me to the place where I could let go of the past. And so I have to spend the first 2/3 of the book telling you all the reasons I have that I need to forgive this man. I can't
And that's understandable. I mean, but next you're going to tell me you've had a Sasquatch experience. I'm just saying.
No.
Okay.
Sorry. I don't like the deep woods that much. I'm sure if I were there, maybe I would think I'd see something, but that's not on my resume.
UFO experience? No?
I don't think so, no.
No? Not in all that time dealing with airlines and space and all that other stuff writing?
Here's the thing. It's not like you are a, you know, full cart that if you believe in one, you believe in another. I think our experiences inform our beliefs. Mm-hmm. And my particular experience is with spirits from the afterlife.
Yep.
And how they've informed my life. I personally feel like there've got to be other civilizations. The universe is so big. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hubris to think that we're the only ones here.
Yeah.
But I personally haven't encountered any aliens myself, but I hypothetically, I I think it makes sense that there would be some.
Very true. Very true. I tell you what, let's take our break early. When we come back, let's dive into this and get into The Ghost Marriage, a memoir. That's the name of the book. Kirsten Micklewaite. I'm not going to screw that up, Kirsten. I swear I won't, because I'm a Minnesotan. We pronounce it two different ways. Kirsten Micklewaite is our guest. She's the author of The Ghost Marriage, a memoir. We have a link to the book in the description of the show. Go ahead and click it during the break. When we come back, we will tell you exactly what, not exactly what happens, but we'll get through a little bit of what's going on with this this book and why it has been written, and a little bit about those characters in the book. We'll check that out when we come back on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our subject today is The Ghost Marriage, a memoir. It's been written by our guest, Kirsten Micklewaite. And we're about to jump into it, folks, exactly what this book is all about. And Kirsten, it's safe to say that this book is about your life.
It's about a decade in my life.
A decade. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, a decade in your life. And it's safe to say that it wasn't the best decade in your life, correct?
No, it was pretty much the worst decade in my life. Yeah. It was, you know, my marriage fell apart. My husband had been a very successful civil litigation attorney. And so he was very skilled in litigation and manipulation. He was also going through an emotional sort of downward spiral. And a lot of people have asked me, well, was he a narcissist? Was he, you know, bipolar? What was he? You know, and I don't have a tidy diagnosis to give you, but he underwent a big personality change. And after we split up, he revealed to me that he had been addicted to opioids. Ooh. So there was just this big stew of bad behavior and broken hearts and bad feelings. And
well, let's start from the beginning, because I mean, it's easy to look at the aftermath or look at the bad right away. But tell us a little bit about what made you fall in love with them.
So, and I do go into this. I spend the first chapter or two giving the backstory on our marriage. I met him at a friend's wedding in San Francisco, and he set out to win my heart in a very convincing way. He was, you know, generous and fun, and we just had a great time. And within, I think, 3 months of meeting, he'd asked me to marry him.
Wow, that's quick.
Yeah, it was quick.
Yeah.
And then we quickly moved in together. And within a year of meeting, we were married. I wanted to go slower, but he was the kind of personality that you don't say no to him very easily, and you get caught up. You know, he presents everything so well. And so we got married. We had a great life. We traveled a lot. We bought a home. Our first real challenge was having a family. So he had four daughters from his first marriage. They were all teenagers at that point. And I got along with them. They never lived with us, but we, you know, we included them in our lives.
Let me ask you. Okay, so let's go a little slower here, and let's break it down a little bit more. So let's start with the travel. When you go to travel, is he catering to you? Is he wanting to take you to the spots you've always wanted to go to, or is it mainly places he wanted to go to? Were you splitting your interests as far as travel went?
It was kind of mutual. He had been a really, really passionate scuba diver. And in fact, when we were engaged, he was getting his PADI certification so he could be a PADI instructor.
Okay.
He did force me to learn to scuba dive. I did not want to learn how to scuba dive. And he basically wore me down until I did. So yeah, he could be very... he wouldn't let it go. If he wanted something, he didn't stop until he got it. Yeah, I definitely see that pattern now. But when we met, I had just come back from living a year in Italy, and I started a newsletter, a quarterly newsletter about travel to Italy. And so we went to Italy twice a year. So it was kind of mutual, you know. Okay. He would give me things that I wanted, but they usually came with a quid pro quo. But no, it was, everything was fine. You know, when you move in with someone, when you marry someone, you know, there's compromise, and yeah, there's learning people's personalities. And I definitely learned that if he didn't get his way, you know, I would have to work with him to kind of pull him out of that.
So wait, now, when you say work with him to pull him out of that, you're realizing that there's a negative characteristic to him as he's not getting his way. So when you say work, how hard are you working?
Well, just for example, you know, if we had an argument, he would just go silent.
Okay.
And I would have to be the one to say, okay, let's sit down, let's talk about it. And one time I said, you know what, I'm tired of being the mom here. I'm just going to wait for him to come around. And it just didn't happen. Like 3 days later, he was still not speaking to me. And so finally I was like, look, you're 38 years old. We're married. Is this really how you want to do this? But I realized that he just hadn't learned those skills. You know, I'd grown up in a very functional family, and I had parents who used their words and, you know, talked things through, and he'd had a very different upbringing. So there was a lot of stuff like that where I felt like, okay, you know, I guess there's a learning curve here. But still, I want to emphasize that for the first 10 to 12 years, overall, I felt like things were going pretty well.
Okay, so let me ask you this then. As you are starting to date him, eventually you do find out about the children that are involved in the relationship. I mean, obviously, it had to be pretty quick within the relationship.
Children from the first marriage, you mean?
Yeah, from the first marriage.
Yeah, I knew about that immediately.
Okay. So does it throw you at all, or is it like, oh, okay, well, you're in your mid-30s, late-30s, it's to be expected type deal. And when you first meet them, were there any red flags? Did they act oddly towards their father?
No, they were very loving towards their father. You know, four teenage girls, that's a lot, you know, but I had not had children of my own. I had not raised a teenage daughter of my own to know how big a package that can be.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Teenage girls are really a handful just emotionally. And, but like I said, they never lived with us. So I never had to really be warmly received by them. But one of the things I say in the book is, I was naive. I was ignorant. You know, I had never been married before. I'd never had children of my own. And I did not recognize that they were still dealing with their parents' divorce and mm-hmm. their father meeting someone else very quickly. It really wasn't until the end of my own marriage when I looked back and said, these girls are still in some kind of pain, and I'm sorry that I certainly tried to be close to them, but it wasn't my place to solve that for them. I was kind of an outsider. So
did you find yourself getting a lot of resistance from them? Maybe more so than you would any ordinary stepmom?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-mm. Okay. So they were pretty accepting of you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good to know. So you've inherited four stepdaughters and things. How would you describe things with him? Like, say, the first couple of years of your marriage, did it seem as loving as it should have been, or was he pretty much throwing tantrums right away?
No. I mean, I gave that as an example to a specific question of yours, but
okay.
Overall, we were very happy.
Okay.
And he adored me and I adored him. And, you know, we lived a great lifestyle, but we were, we really did enjoy each other's company. And so, yes, there were little bumps and hurdles along the way, as in every relationship. But I really just thought, you know, I won the lottery here. Mm-hmm. You know, I got this great guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as you're living this charmed life, so to speak, where does it start? Where do the cracks start in this? Where do you start to realize that things aren't as they should be?
So he worked in San Francisco. I had worked in Berkeley. And then when we had our second child, before we had our second child, I left my job to become a full-time mom. And at that point, he pushed very hard for us to move full-time to the Napa Valley. We had bought a weekend place up there and we spent weekends there. And he had grown up in the country in upstate New York, and he really wanted to move to St. Helena, which is this just idyllic little town in the middle of the wine country. And I said, well, how's that going to work? You know, you work in the city and, you know, should something happen, there's nothing for me to do up there. You know, my work is down here because I was working in higher ed. And he said, we'll make it work. You know, I'll work sometimes from home and, you know, we'll make all these arrangements. So we moved full time up to the Napa Valley and he was commuting, you know, 4 hours a day to get to and from work. The traffic, you know, takes that long. And so at first it was fine because he was working a lot from home, but then he joined a new firm and they wanted more FaceTime in the office. And it was just starting to wear him down. And at this point we had a toddler and a newborn. Mm. And he had really been participating in, you know, caring for the children. And, you know, it really felt, I was a liberated woman. I did not see myself as a stay-at-home housewife. You know, I wanted to have his input whenever possible. And he just, you know, things started shredding at the seams because it was not really a realistic living situation. And so at some point, a few years down the road, we got him a loft, a condo in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And he lived down there during the week and came home on weekends. And so now I'm a single mom during the week, mm. albeit, you know, one that doesn't have to work. I admit that. It's not like I was trying to put food on the table, but he's gone every weekend or every week and comes back on the weekend. So you can see where the marriage is starting to, it's, you know, we're not getting the FaceTime that we need.
Right.
And our lives are going in two very different directions. And then he just started getting more and more unhappy. He really did not enjoy being a lawyer anymore. We'd talk about it and I'd say, let's scale down. Let's not have, you know, by then we had an expensive house in the Napa Valley. We had a loft in the Bay Area. We had two rental properties. And then he wanted to buy this farm property. So at some point we had five properties, huge overhead, which was fine as long as he was earning, you know, the salary of a successful attorney, but he wasn't happy doing that. And so I said, let's just get rid of all this stuff so you can find something you enjoy doing. And he was the one who said, I'm not ready to give up the lifestyle. I like the lifestyle too much. So this went on for years. And then he lost his main client. He took some risks that he shouldn't have taken with his client. And they said, we're changing counsel. And he didn't really have any other, you know, that had been his meat and potatoes. He had a staff of like 10 working for him on this client. And he said, not to worry, I have a business idea. And so then he spent several years on this new business, which we were pouring hundreds of thousands of dollars into it. And he wasn't a businessman. You know, he had a great idea, but I just don't think, I think he missed the window for doing what he wanted to do. It was insurance claims. And one day I guess by then we might have been separated. At some point, I was just like, I can't live with you anymore. You're too unhappy. And yet he was still spending money. He had enormous appetites for things. And he came over one day and he said, we're going to have to fold up our tent. It just didn't work. So now he doesn't have the business. He doesn't have the career. And he tried to get back into the legal profession, but he didn't have a book of business. You know, never was able to really make that work. So he basically lost everything he ever wanted. He had everything he wanted, and he basically made choices that cost him those things, including me, his wife.
And it sounds like he was a very prideful man. It sounds like, you know, that there's a personality there that, and without knowing him, it sounds like he built everything based on pride.
He was an alpha male through and through.
Yeah.
And that was attractive. You know, men loved him, women loved him, dogs loved him. Mm-hmm. But it also had a real downside. And when a guy like that loses his position and loses the things he cares about, it's not pretty. He turned very angry. And so once I wanted to separate and then divorce, he did everything in his power to take me down financially, the kids, socially. He started, you know, dating my friends. He became engaged to a woman who had been my friend, who was also our real estate agent. She was representing us.
Wow.
To sell our house, and he got engaged to her. I mean, he stopped at nothing to try to destroy me, emotionally, financially. And, it was a lot. And as I say in the book, you know, I was so naive, and I was trying so hard just to keep the boat afloat that I did not anticipate every time he took me by surprise, every single time, because I wasn't focused on, oh, what's he going to do next? I was focused on cleaning up the mess I had just lived through.
It always baffles me why someone with that much pride, and as you pointed out, narcissism, why attack the person who was the closest to them? I mean, you did nothing. You did nothing but...
I left him. I got off his bus. And I don't think anybody had ever done that to him before. He was the one who left his first marriage. He was the one who always called the shots. And I was the first woman who said, let me off. And he couldn't handle it.
But Kirsten, what else were you going to do? I mean, somebody had to raise the two children, right?
Well, he got 50% custody. He wasn't working. And he said, I want to spend time with my kids. I think there was also the fact that if he had 50%, he wouldn't have to pay me child support.
Well, that's what it was. Yeah.
I got zero child support. I got zero alimony. And I had not been working for 12 years. And I was living in this very rural town where, you know, there weren't a lot of options for me. So I was kind of stranded. But I mean, that's the way people like that work. You know, they're not, it's easy for you as a rational person to look back and say, why would he do that? But he was operating out of pure emotion and a need for revenge. And to his dying breath, he was trying to take me down.
Which, I realize what you're saying. As a rational person, you can't wrap your head around why you would go after, especially the mother of your children, why you would
right.
have that much vitriol for one person.
Yep.
You mentioned the words dying breath. So obviously there's a further spiral there. Tell me what, and obviously you just also mentioned the words had another wife, and it was your real estate agent.
Let me clarify that.
Okay.
I meant his first wife.
Oh, his first wife. Okay.
Yeah. He never ended up marrying.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Let me scratch that. So he obviously from this point on gets a hold of something for his own demise. He finds a way to circle the drain, so to speak. What is it that he dips into that takes him down?
So when we separated, I guess we were getting COBRA health insurance from his firm for a while. But after a point, I got us our own health insurance for me and the kids. Mm-hmm. And I told him, here's the number for Blue Shield. You need to get your own insurance. I will take care of the insurance for me and the kids. And apparently he never did that. He was a lawyer and he was, he spent money on all kinds of things, but I guess he didn't want to spring for health insurance. And so over a period of about 4 years, and I didn't realize this until it had gotten really serious, he did not see a doctor. And he was having symptoms and feeling very sick, but he did not go to the doctor because he did not have health insurance. So he got colon cancer, and at one point he drove himself into the ER because he was in so much pain, and they did a workup on him, and by then it was stage four colon cancer. So he died of colon cancer. It was totally curable if he had, gotten screened and seen a doctor. And the real irony is, and I only learned about this from a friend at his funeral, we have a fabulous veterans center just 10 minutes away from where we lived, where he could have gotten, because he was a veteran, he mm-hmm. could have gotten all his health care for free.
Really?
And I don't know how he didn't know that as a veteran. I wasn't aware of it, but that's one of the things you get as a veteran is you can go there and get all your health care. And he could have totally, I really feel like he had a death wish that he was, on this downward spiral. That's all I can figure.
Well, and that was going to be my next question is, do you feel like that anger had turned inward and become depression?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And don't forget the opioids. He had had a couple of back surgeries during the course of our marriage and had gotten hooked on Vicodin. And a couple of times he had told me, I'm still taking the Vicodin. I really want to get off of this. But again, I was such a trusting, naive person. I never went through his bathroom drawers. I was never like, oh, Vicodin, how much are you taking? I trusted him that he was an adult. And if there was a problem, he would have told me. But after we split up, he said, I've been addicted to Vicodin all this time. And it affects my moods. And that's why I've been so, mean. And at that point I said, a great time to have told me about that would have been, 4 years ago or whatever, but
so
I just never saw it coming.
When does he confess to the fact that he's been addicted to Vicodin? Is it towards the end or when does he say this?
It was after we'd split up and he would vacillate between anger, I'm going to take you down, to crying and wanting me to come back. He was going between, he was vacillating between moods. And during one of the regretful times, he said, I've been addicted to Vicodin. And that's why I've, you know, that's why my mood has been so bad over the past 5 years. And I just was like, you know what? I'm not giving you a do-over for that. You know, you should have told me.
Did he ever once say, Kirsten, I need help. Can you get me into a treatment center?
No.
Mm-mm. No.
No, by the time we were separated, I knew I wanted out. I had been trying to do so many things during our marriage and trying to keep it together for the kids. I felt honestly like my soul was dying, that I was no longer, I was losing myself by trying to keep him in a good mood and trying to keep everything good for the kids. I felt like if I keep this up, I'm going to lose myself. And that's when I made the decision to leave. So once we separated, you know, I really worked hard to keep things friendly, and I did all kinds of things for him. You know, I'd have him over for dinner and I'd bring him his mail, and really tried to keep things as civil as possible, but I knew I wasn't going back.
Kirsten, I hate to keep dwelling on this, but I just kind of have to ask you this question or throw out this point, and that is this. Do you almost feel like when he says to you in that moment of weakness, in an interior weakness, that he's addicted to Vicodin, do you almost, not that he's necessarily reaching out to you as a lifeline, but do you almost feel like he's dropping breadcrumbs for you? That he's giving you clues like, you know what, if something does happen, look into this?
No, I didn't feel that.
No?
Mm-mm. Maybe he had premonitions of his own death, or maybe he, you know, went through periods of depression where he wanted it. But at the very end, he was raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during our marriage, he never entered a church, you know, except for weddings and funerals. He didn't spend any time on spirit at all. And he started to get really scared because I think he was afraid of where he was going. Yeah. After he died, you know, the old Catholic
guilt
belief system. Yeah. The guilt. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He started to get really scared. And so I don't think he was trying to die, but I think he just, like I said, got caught up in this sort of whirlpool and just went down and down and down.
It wouldn't surprise me if he wanted to kill the pain, but he didn't want to kill himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he definitely did. I think that's what Vicodin does for you. It just puts you in this more of a twilight. You know, it makes you not care as much.
Yeah.
And one of the things he said to his children toward the very end was, you're the one thing I did right in this life, because all of his children were helping to care for him at the end. And, or most of them, I should say. And he had that moment of clarity, like, I did something right, and that was you kids. So I'm glad he had that. But I think also in that admission was all the things he did wrong.
Yeah.
He lost everything. He lost everything.
That's true.
But I want to get to what happened after he died.
Yes, let's get to that. Yes, yes. I just wanted to make sure that we had gotten clear as to what had happened when he died and how he died, because that truly sets up what happens after he dies. And why don't you go ahead and launch into that?
Well, I will tell you that the moment he died, I believe I had some kind of astral projection.
Okay.
I woke up in the middle of the night, and obviously I wasn't fully awake, but I felt like I was not asleep. And what I saw was kind of this blue light, like a video camera was filming something. And I saw a blanket on a bed. I sensed that there were people moving around. I saw a left arm with a blue plastic bracelet on it.
Hmm.
And I had a moment of my own clarity at that moment, thinking, uh-oh, because we were basically waiting. We knew he was going to die any day. And I just thought, this feels very much like a death scene. I went back to sleep. And when I woke up, there was a message on my machine. It was his eldest daughter who said he died at 5 or 5:30 this morning. Mm. And we talked about it. You know, I said, did he go easily? She said he fought till the end. And she said, until the very end, he, you know, like he didn't want to give me power of attorney over the kids' college funds, for example, that I should have been on years before. He refused up to his dying breath. It was like, she's getting none of that. Finally, I said, was there any kind of a blue bracelet on his left arm? And she said, yeah, his hospital bracelet. Why do you ask? And I was just like, I was there. I was somehow, you know, I got some kind of fuzzy, grainy footage of the moment that he went. So after he went, I was still dealing with so much anger and fear, because one of the things we didn't touch on was that in our divorce settlement, he had, I had gotten the primary house. He had gotten the other four properties, which were rentals and weekend homes and such. Mm-hmm. And he had a year to get my name off of those loans. Okay. Both of our names had been on all those properties. Mm-hmm. And a year passed and my name was still on the loans. He needed to either refinance or sell those properties. There's no other way to get my name off. And he refused to sell and he couldn't refinance because he had no job. And as his health declined, I was just getting more and more upset about it. Like, you have to get my name off you have to sell those properties because you're going to leave them on me. So by the time he died, one of the properties had foreclosed and one was in pre-foreclosure. And I had buyers for both of them, but he would not let me, you know, he was kind of sticking in the way of that. And the other two were short sold. But the total of those loans, plus a credit card I didn't know about, was $1.5 million.
Oh.
That was now my debt on my name. And the kicker was the credit card he had used to buy our daughter a truck that we bought together, and he said he would finance it. Uh-huh. He put it on a credit card that was still in my name that I didn't even know about. And so that $16,000 truck, by the time I got it, was $20,000 on Visa that I was left to deal with. But the real kicker was, when he was in the hospital for a week, when he was first diagnosed, he stayed in the St. Helena hospital for a week. The bill was $125,000. And he, as we know, had no insurance, but he told them that he was on my insurance.
No.
I did not know that because all of the bills, all of the credit notices were going to him at his address. And after he died, his eldest daughter forwarded all his mail to me, and I started opening this up. And there was this letter from the hospital saying this is going to the reporting agencies. And I called and I said, this is not my bill. And she said, well, he said you were the responsible party. I said, we're divorced. He said, oh, he told us your divorce wasn't yet final. And they didn't check. So yes, I was able to get that off, but it had been on my credit. You know, my credit was an F because of this thing. So, like I said, I had a lot of forgiving to do, and I had a plan. I had a timeline for my forgiveness because I knew I wanted to forgive because I didn't want to carry that around for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But I felt like there's no way I can sincerely forgive this man until I am made whole financially. Mm-hmm. And most of that was done in the first 8 months, but the whole credit issue took 8 years. Whoa. So I was not planning on forgiving him for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But he started communicating with me, and I can give you some of those stories.
Sure.
And I went to see a psychic. And completely against my own wishes, I had a moment where I just put my head down on the desk and I said, I forgive you, Steve. It it just, something came over me. It was something spiritual. I think my soul or my psyche just knew I did not want to carry this around for another 8 years. So I actually forgave him years before I thought I was going to. And then I saw a psychic to help me interpret all of the messages he was giving me from the afterlife. And what I learned was that we had jointly decided when we came into this life that we would have a soul contract and we would teach each other lessons. And this was his way of teaching me these lessons. And through the medium, he told me, I played my part perfectly. I did everything you asked me to do. And I ultimately accepted that these were lessons that I had chosen, like before I came into this life, and he was my greatest teacher. How do you like that?
Oh, wait. Okay, wait a minute. Now, I can hear people screaming and throwing their device across the room right now as you say, this is the lesson I chose for myself. So you chose to put yourself in like $1.7 million worth of debt, Kirsten?
Well, that's what I said. I said, who does that?
Yeah.
But I fixed it. I got out of it. I survived it. I not only survived, I thrived, and I protected my children through all of it. And I just have to tell you, it's like people who get cancer, and almost all of them, once they get out of it again, say, this is the biggest gift of my life. And I, as one who have never had cancer, knock wood, say, how all that you went through, how can you consider that a gift? But when you go through it and you come out of it, you see the world differently and you are more grateful and you understand how resilient you are. It was a gift. What can I tell you? It was a gift.
That's one hell of an expensive gift.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? Today, my credit score is an A and I have a great job with benefits. I was able to buy my own house. My kids are both launched and they're great. And, you know, a lot of people who read my book, well, not a lot, but the few bad reviews I've gotten of The Ghost Marriage are people who just can't get past the fact that I had this affluent life, you know, for maybe 10 mm-hmm. years of my life. Mm-hmm. And they say, she had everything. What is she complaining about? You know, she had college funds for her kids and she was able to buy a house. And, you know, she just a whiny rich woman. But I lost it all. I lost it all. And mm-hmm. had I continued to be that person and live that lifestyle, and I know a lot of people like this who are still living that life, you know, back, I'm no longer in St. Helena. I have something better. I have something better. And I know that no matter what I go through, I have that strength and resilience.
Yeah.
And that determination. And I did not know that about myself before.
Yeah.
And this was the man who, again, not the way I would have chosen to learn it, but if any of your listeners believe in reincarnation, mm-hmm. they need to read a book called Sacred Contracts by Carolyn Mace, M-Y-S-S. And I had read that book many years before, so I understood the concept already. But yeah, the people who teach us the things in this life are not just the great teachers, you know, like our favorite English teacher. Mm-hmm. There are enemies. There are disabled children. They are the people who make us work and suffer the most. Those are our teachers.
Very true. You said that there were some stories you could tell us about communiques from Stephen.
Yeah.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what he said from beyond the grave.
Sure. I can give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
And this was mostly the first 6 months to a year after he passed.
Okay.
I have to say, I don't get these regular, clearly obvious messages
right.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So something you may already know is that when people pass, they use electromagnetic energy mm-hmm. so that if someone dies, like when my dad passed, we had 42 light bulbs in this house and 14 of them burned out the week that he passed, like just sizzled and died.
Yep.
So let's just start with that premise. My daughter was watching TV. She was home after he died and, she basically camped out on the sofa and didn't move for 6 months or 3 months. And I came down and she said, "What's wrong with the TV?" And I said, "Nothing. It's, you know, that I know of." And she said, "Well, it keeps flipping channels." And I said, "Well, is it the DVR that's programmed? Is it this? Is it that?" She said, no, it's just flipping channels. Like, I'm just watching live TV." And finally I said, "Well, what show is it flipping to?" And she said, "Oh, it's this show I used to watch with Daddy."
Uh-huh.
So I said, "Well, I think that's your dad." Because I've believed this kind of stuff most of my adult life. And I've, you know, brought my children up kind of in the same way. Like I would mm-hmm. talk about it like that's a thing. Like if you, you know, if grandma dies and you get this sign, well, that's just grandma.
Right.
So she just accepted. She was like, "Yeah, that's what I thought." So I walked into the kitchen. I was still super mad at Steve. And I said, "You know, not that I want to hear from you because I am not speaking to you right now, but if I did, what would that sign be?" And I thought, what would a good sign be that I would know it was Steve? And I'm really embarrassed of this idea that I came up with because I'm not proud of it. But when we were first married, he got a car allowance from his firm.
Okay.
And he was able to lease a luxury car. And so we picked this beautiful brown Mercedes, but we had the interior custom ordered so mm-hmm. that instead of the beige interior that it came with, it had a chocolate brown interior.
Okay.
And we drove that car for, you know, till the lease was up and then we turned it in. And after that, every time I saw that brown Mercedes on the road, I would look to see if it had the chocolate brown interior because I would know that was our car because nobody else had that interior.
Sure.
But I never, never did. And, you know, over 20 years, I'd always just kind of reflexively look. And then I thought, that's a really stupid sign to ask from, you know, 22 years of marriage. All you can think of is a Mercedes. So then I thought of this punchline to a joke we used to tell. And I'm not going to tell you the joke because it's too stupid, but it was Peter Sellers based.
Okay.
And punchline was Carabinieri, which is the Italian military police. And, okay. you know, we used to travel a lot in Italy and we had this joke about the Carabinieri. And I said, if I see that word, that Italian word, you know, in the paper or anywhere within the next week, I will consider that a sign from Steve. So literally like 2 or 3 days later, I'm in the kitchen making breakfast. The TV is on the news and I turn and in 2-inch high letters across the screen says Carabinieri.
Wow.
It was a story set in Italy, but the story they were telling really had nothing. You know, it wasn't specific to Carabinieri. It was a plaque. Like, huh. you know, that you would enter into a building or something.
Yeah.
And I just stopped and I said, "Okay, I get it. You're there. You thank you for that acknowledgement." So then like a day or two later, I was out walking the dog and I'm coming back to our driveway and parked on the street is a brown Mercedes. And I said, "Oh, no, you didn't." And I walk up. And I look in and it's the chocolate brown leather interior.
Wow.
And I walked around the car. I took a picture of it with my phone. I said, "I'd never seen this car there before. I never saw it again." And I just said, "How did you do that?" So that was kind of the beginning of me feeling like he wants to get in touch with me. And I believe that when we pass, we go back to being our higher selves. Like we come down here and we make a mess of things and we learn our lessons and we're horrible people sometimes. Mm-hmm. But when we cross over, we're back to just our pure soul and we're our higher people. So I felt like he wasn't the person that I hated anymore. I felt like he was back to, you know, the way we are as babies, as children. But I still wasn't ready to talk to him.
Okay.
But eventually I did decide, okay, I'm ready to have a conversation with him. And I have a few other examples if you want.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
But I just want to finish this, which is I went to see the psychic and she said, you know, I walked in, I didn't tell her anything. She didn't know that this guy had, and the last time I had seen her was like 4 years before. So she knew me, but she didn't remember anything about me. And she said, I'm getting a husband, father energy. He was cremated, but he was also buried. And that was my husband. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen. I mean, I don't know anybody else who was both cremated and buried.
I do. My great aunt, but go ahead.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it's unusual.
Yeah, it is. So
I said, yeah, that's my ex-husband. I thought he'd be here. And she said, he's holding out an antique key. And when they show me a key, it usually means a car. Mm-hmm. Are you selling a car? Are you buying a car? What's up with the car? And I said, ask him if it's a brown Mercedes. And she said, he's laughing really hard. And I told her the story. And she said, I don't know how they do that, but I hear those stories all the time. So to me, that was the biggest demonstration of his trying to get through. He told the psychic, he said, finally, I got her in here and I can turn this thing around and she can understand that I did this at her request, that the person I was down here was fulfilling a lesson that she asked to learn before she came in.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
The other stories you said you had?
I don't remember this on the timeline. It's in my book, but several times I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought there was an intruder. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a man in my bed. His arm was around my waist. We were like spooning. And I could feel his whole body up against mine and he would like massage my neck. And the first time it happened, I thought there is a man in my bed. I am going to be raped and then I am probably going to be killed. And I just lay there in complete terror because it was that real. It was a physical body in my bed.
Now, did Stephen do that in life when the two of you were together?
Yeah, he probably did, like back in our happily married days. Okay. Yeah, we would spoon and, you know.
But it had been a while, so it didn't feel familiar.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I hadn't shared a bed with him in, at that point, 2006, at least 5 years.
Okay.
But I thought it was a physical human being in my bed. The feeling was so strong. And I just lay there thinking, you know, how do I get out of bed? Do I turn on a light? I mean, I was really strategizing how to save my own life. And then I just kind of lay there and the feeling kind of dissipated. And all of a sudden I went, oh, that was Steve. And he did it another several times. And each time I was alarmed. I woke up thinking someone was there because it felt that real. Mm-hmm. But then I realized, okay, that's Steve.
Wow. Yikes. Mm-hmm. That would be alarming, especially if you're not expecting it, but yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the, to you, what is the message behind that? I mean, is it just he wished there would have been more time to show you how he felt about you? Or is it just a gentle nudge from beyond saying he's still there with you? I don't get what that particular act is about.
I think wanting to let me know that he's not only in the afterlife, but he, and You know, I've watched a lot of Long Island Medium episodes.
Okay.
I think she's very good. The psychic I went to works the same way. She gets the same kind of signs. They want to let us know that they're here with us. Like every time we think of them, you know, she said, you visit his grave a lot. You know, once I was on the forgiveness path, I would go to his grave and I would leave a stone. I really like that Jewish tradition of leaving a stone as opposed to flowers. She said, he's showing me that you go there often. And every time you go, he's there. And I believe that our loved ones are, they know everything we're doing. You know, they know, like when I went to the medium, she, the first time she said, there's a whole line of people here waiting to speak to you. Mm-hmm. And it was all of my loved ones that had passed that knew I was going to be there that day. So I just feel like he wanted to let me know that he's there and that he was no longer the person I spent so many years being so angry with and fearing, you know, that he was an ally again. And honestly, you know, this book, it's not flattering of him for a big part of the book. He is redeemed in the end of it. But the medium told me, she said, he's got the biggest smile on his face. He, by putting this book out there, you are helping him to advance on the other side by telling the story of this lesson, but you're also attracting people who need to forgive people who have passed on. And you are helping them, and you are helping the spirits on the other side with this message of forgiveness. So I just feel like this book is something that was on my path that I was supposed to do, and it's helping me and it's helping other people spiritually.
That's good. That, I mean, that's what it should be doing. And absolutely. I believe you are doing that. It's stupid for me to ask this question after you've wrapped that up so eloquently. I take it that the bed session, for lack of a better term, was after you had forgiven him.
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. It may have just been him saying, come on, you know, loved me once. Here I am again. I don't remember. It's in the book.
Yeah. And we'll leave people to look that up in the book as far as timeline goes. Did you have any other stories you wanted to share as far as?
As my publication date for this book approached, I started to get really nervous, both about, you know, this is a very vulnerable story to tell.
Yeah.
And you're with memoir, you're putting not only your book out there, but your life out there. And I started having very vivid dreams of him, like for the 2 weeks leading up to the publication. And I hadn't dreamt about him for a very long time. So I think he comes in through my dreams now more than any other manner.
That I was just going to ask that kind of as we're wrapping up here, I was going to ask, do you have any communications with him these days? Is it something where you feel like he's still around, or do you feel like there's finally closure to this part of communication with him in this life? And as far as that goes,
I do talk to him now that I really feel like if I want to say something to him, I feel like he can hear it. Specifically things about our kids. You know, if I'm worried about one of them, I will say, can you please pull some strings if you have them? Or just thank you. You know, I know how proud he would be of both of our kids. I'm sorry he did not live long enough to see them as real adults. And, but I feel like he is seeing them. And, so yeah, there's still that kind of communication, but there's no real manifestations the way there used to be. That happened closer to his actual death.
If there's reincarnation and the two of you end up together or you're in the same soul family and you end up together in the next life, what is your wish for what happens in the next life?
Oh my God. Well, I asked Karen, the medium, I said, does this mean that our contract is done? You know, am I done with this with him? And she said, absolutely, your karmic agreement is closed now. That doesn't mean that I don't have other lessons with him or this same lesson with somebody else. But we did the work that we needed to do with this. I would say, I hope if he and I are in another life together, I hope he goes easier on me. What can I say?
What if let's play what if for a second here. What if the situations are reversed? What if it's your turn to dish a little on him? What would you expect on that?
I have no way of predicting that. You know, I am in this mind, in this body, and, you know, I could be the evil one next time. Absolutely. You know, that's the way karma works. So
if you had to, after almost $1.7 million worth of damage, if you had to think of a fitting punishment, what would you inflict? I don't want you to go to a negative place by any means, but if you had to come up with your own karmic justice in the next life, what would you dish out?
I hate to disappoint you, Tim, but one of my realizations at the very end of his life was, of all the revenge that I fantasized about or could fantasize about to get revenge on Steve, there was nothing I would have done that was as bad as what he did to himself. He punished himself way more than I would have punished him. I mean, there were times I left his house and I would just sit in my car and scream at the top of my lungs because I was so frustrated. But when you think of what he did to himself, you know, health, he lost his marriage. He lost his whole financial, you know, everything he had built up. He lost his career. He lost friends. I couldn't have outdone that. And, I don't want to get revenge on him in any other way. That the book feels totally closed to me.
That's an appropriate and good response right there. I do believe. Kirsten, I want to thank you very much for joining me today. It was a very fulfilling discussion today. I really did enjoy it. It really did broaden some horizons today. I do thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim. It was a pleasure.
The name of the book is The Ghost Marriage, a memoir. Our guest has been Kirsten Micklewaite. The link for this book is in the description of the show. Just click on that link and follow that link to get the book. Kirsten, I did want to ask you, is there any other website you wanted people to check out while they're at it?
Just my website, KirstenMicklewaite.com. I'm also available on Facebook and Instagram. Those links are on my website.
Sounds good. All right, folks. Want to remind you before we go, again, the UFO Disclosure Symposium, there's a link in the description as well for that. Check out the ticket prices for that. There's a VIP package for that. There's a general admission package for that. And of course, if you want to view it from home, you don't have to leave on Memorial Day weekend your home to enjoy that symposium. You can just click on the link for streaming that symposium as well. There's three different packages there, and you will be able to see four different videos that were previously top secret that are now available to you only at that symposium. That symposium is going to be a newsworthy symposium. By all means, click on the link, check it out. It costs nothing to look at the link, look at who's going to be appearing there, and see for yourself, for the first time ever, four different videos that were top secret up until the symposium. Folks, I also want to remind you, as the theme of the week has been about relationships and different relationships, familial relationships, love relationships, and basically treating each other a little bit better, treating each other with kindness, treating each other as we should be treating each other as we're coming out of two different religions, Holy Weeks, to be a little bit kinder to each other this week. From here on out, being a little bit better to each other each and every day. A reminder to treat each other with a little more kindness. The world is becoming a little colder, a little crueler. So take a deep breath before you think about spitting a little more venom out there in the world. Take a deep breath and look at that person across from you and realize that they too have issues going on in this world. And a reminder that we really should be a little bit better to each other. That'll do it for this week. Join us again next week for the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.